I was saying at the start of the talk that the turn of my own mind was sceptical, and I'm suddenly anxious that I'm starting to sound culpably optimistic. But something else that Sally King says is that the Tathagatagarbha Sutra is optimistic, but it's not naive. Another bit of James Hillman. I know James Hillman because Attila reads a lot of James Hillman, and I really try to understand what he's getting at one of these days. But Hillman, who is an archetypal psychologist, is very, very suspicious of the language of spiritual practice. He's very suspicious about the split that it brings into experience. He's very suspicious of a language that affirms the heights and ignores the depths. And he's much, much more, he argues for a sort of pantheism of the psyche. Very, very cautious of its spiritual language. And I suppose I'm sort of struck here how at ease the Tathagatagarbha Sutra is with difficult experience. All of the metaphors are to do with doubt. Right? The Buddha's wrapped in rags, or you've got gold in a pile of waste, or you've got something in a scorched earth mould. Right, you get this idea, you get it in Shantideva as well, don't you? The jewel in the dung heap. Right? It completely values the jewel, it's completely cool with the fact that you're going to have to stick your hand in a dung heap to extract it. And what I'd like to suggest here is that, we're back to this relationship of what your experience actually is and what it is that you're trying to move towards and what's the relationship between those. I'm not going to exhaust this, I'm not going to do it justice, but just to give you one little quote from an American Tibetan teacher called Pema Chodron, and she says, the real spiritual quality that you're looking for is not the avoidance of pain and the maximising of pleasure. She's saying, in a sense, it's pathetic if you go through your life motivated by that. What you really want is a vivid curiosity that's interested in every experience. And she says, you want an awareness that's at ease with the heat of the fire as well as the warmth of the fire. You want an awareness that's at ease with the turbulence of water as well as the smoothness of water. You want an awareness that's so still and so stable that it can welcome that full range of the experience of our own minds. And this is, I hope I'm not reading too much into this, but this is something I think of what the sutra is suggesting. It's like saying it's possible to be open to your full range of experience, actually necessary. It's necessary to get awareness in there. Like people don't see the Buddha buried in the rags. It takes somebody with vision to see that, to get through it, and to expose the gold. Awareness is necessary, but you're not possessed by the kleshas. You're able to take awareness so deeply into them that you see their fundamental nature. And again, I hope I'm not being too glib, but the Hakuin quote, that the fundamental nature is no nature. That it let every other mental phenomenon, they come into being and they pass. And if you don't get caught up in it, you can let it go. And in not moving to this or to that, you're left in a space that's bigger than anything that you were trapped in before. So that's the first point. It's optimistic, but not naive. Second point is a connected point, actually, about its realism. Sally King says that it's not teaching that you're born fundamentally good. Right. It's not a sort of Rousseauist romantic position. It's not saying that actually take away the damage that's been done to by your parents and you're left with a sort of fundamental innocence. It's saying that it's not as naive as that. What it's saying is that you've got a potential, but for that potential to mean anything, it's imperative that you manifest it. At present, to all intents and purposes, it's not part of your living experience. For it to become living experience, you have to start to notice the behaviours that give it expression, that bring it into being. Final point is that it affects our approach to practice, or a final point about practice at least. There's a wee Zen aphorism that says you can't make a mirror by polishing a brick. And what it's trying to say is that if it wasn't that your mind had the potential for awareness, there wouldn't be any point in practice. I think quite often our approach to practice is that we don't have it, and we're desperately trying to bring something into being, and after all these years, our efforts still fall discouragingly short of what we thought was possible. Hope I'm not speaking too personally here. And I think one of the implications for this, and one of the practical implications for this, is that we're not working against the grain of our minds, we're working with the grain of our minds. Subhuti says that Buddhahood is not something that we're strenuously inclining towards. In some sense, it's an active force. It's the active force in our own minds that you can start to be receptive to and start to notice the behaviours that express and uncover. What you have to start to do is to start to notice the actions of body, speech and mind that uncover that potential, that express that potential. Our nature fundamentally has changed. This is what I'm getting at by it being a pressure. Our nature's pushing to change. It's not even that it's pushing to change, it is change. Right? And every act of confusion puts a wall around that push to change. Every act of craving puts a wall around that push to change. Every act of awareness gives it space. Every act of emotional opening gives it space. And what we're being asked to do in practice is to learn to tell the difference between the two. Right? What is it that you do that you can feel it traps you? What is it that you do that you can feel liberates you? And the whole of Buddhist practice is trying to articulate the two options open to us. It's an approach to practice. And out of that, I think, comes this whole Zen emphasis of you don't sit to get enlightened, you sit to sit. I think what this means is that it's not that there's something that you don't have, that you're desperately trying to cobble a behaviour together that gets you there. It's more like what you're doing in meditation. When you sit down, when you become still, when you stop the distractions, when you allow that awareness to settle, you're doing something that more appropriately and more fully manifests your fundamental nature than what you were doing before. When you act ethically, you're doing something that manifests your fundamental nature. So it's not that you're trying to bring something into being. You're just aligning yourself with something that's trying to express itself. You're trying to find the behaviours that allow that impulse in your own depth to express itself more and more fully. Subhuti, in one of his talks in the States that I had, said that the most important responsibility that we have as a spiritual practitioner is to guard our sources of inspiration. And when I first heard that, I was thinking, well, we should be studying and listening to talks and all the rest of it. Actually, this has got me thinking about that a little bit differently. It's like, if you're... I don't know if I can explain this quite articulately, but if you're practicing to get something, there's always a strain in it. There's value in that language. But if you see it that the activity itself has meaning, like you know this from your experience of meditation. You sit down, you become aware of yourself. It has a flavour to it. It's a flavour of your psyche joining up, a flavour of wholeness, a flavour of something fuller, deeper, richer than our habitual experience. And actually guarding the sources of inspiration, I think, from this point of view, means starting to plug in to that sense of what you're doing when you're acting ethically, when you're acting out of awareness, in itself feeling meaningful and satisfying. Right, and when you're plugging into something that all of the time is not confronting you with how far short you're falling, you're starting to notice what is it in this act of attention that the flavour of it, the fundamental nature of it, is that it's an experience of unification, it's an experience of wholeness. And guarding our source of inspiration is starting to become sensitive to that flavour, that nourishing flavour of aware experience. And I think this is crucial, actually. I think after a wee while, if your practice is not actually making you happier, why do it? Right? I think you need to be looking for this flavour that your experience is meaning, that this is worth the bother, actually. So there's an approach to practice that's just starting to welcome the meaning of the process rather than always end-gaming it and comparing yourself with where you fall short.